we both believe very strongly, from me from an Anglican viewpoint and Brian from a Catholic viewpoint, that the church has got to relate to society we live in, the issues of the society we live in. We can't ignore scientific understandings. We can't ignore people's deeply held beliefs. And we need to apply the gospel to these. And if we don't, we've moved into what some people call a bubble, some people call a holy huddle. And I think faith becomes irrelevant. I think it has to relate to the world we live in and the issues of the world we live in. And sometimes we will come up with differing opinions within the church, and there's hopefully a healthy debate. But I'm afraid it isn't always healthy that some people just sort of pull down the shutters and say, I'm right, you're wrong. Yeah. Authority says, the Bible says, the church says, therefore you're wrong. We believe God has given us minds to use and a society to live in. We must put the two together.
Yeah, yeah. Hmm? I mean, I suppose you risk falling between two stones from that point of view. I mean, you risk offending potentially the secularists who have, you know, don't really want anything to do with the church or church teachings, but also the traditional people within the church who say, well, you know, if we start appeasing the trends of the time, you know, what they say, that the church that marries to one age finds itself a widow in the next age, you know, that if we give up on these kind of strongly held, deeply held convictions, we're going to find ourselves with no moral truth anymore.
Well, I understand that. I happen to disagree with it, because I think the point of view that Brian and I would take and try and relate to society has the risk of the church being seen to change all the time. Staying with what some people, particularly in the secular world, would regard as outdated attitudes, equally become irrelevant. So we're not ignoring the risks, but we think we have to take them.
And then, Brian, I mean, looking at the title of the book, Does Christ Matter? I mean, even the title is quite provocative in a way.
Well, it's a question about, first of all, does Christ matter to you at all? But secondly, if Christ does, which Christ are you talking about? I actually think we need to be more confident in engaging with secularist people, because it can almost be a default position out there that this faith stuff is either too complicated and we need to move away from it into a concrete world and face reality that there's nothing there after this life. I think we need to challenge that, because a lot of people give out to me about God being so cruel to allow all the cruelty there is in the world. But one of my responses to that is to say, well, okay, let's assume God does not exist. Then who is responsible for all the cruelty in the world? And it turns out to be Mr. Evolution, a new god of evolution. And do we really believe that? I mean, do we believe our own relationships? Do you believe our relationships with our children are simply based on stimulus response? Do we believe our loved ones, that these are something that we're going through, like dog salivating in response to stimuli or something? I don't think anyone believes that. Now, there are serious atheist arguments, and atheist arguments, I think, can purify a lot of terrible religious gods who are bad devils that should never have existed. But I think we need to look at the way we live our lives, the richness that's there, the poetry that's there, and ask ourselves, is the outcome of all this just moon dust? I talked to somebody recently who leads a lot of secularist funerals. And secularist funerals are honest in the sense they're saying they don't believe in an afterlife. But he said at one point he gets people around to commend the person who's dead, as you would in a Christian ceremony. Then the question is, commend to what or to whom? And that silence is there. I don't think we have nice, neat answers to that question. But I think engaging with people at that level of questioning is actually what really matters. And sometimes people say to me, let's deal with married clergy, let's deal with gay issues in the church, let's deal with all this, which we should do. But dealing with those will not actually fill our pews. I think what's going to fill our pews more will be when we actually talk about the Christian relationship with Christ, which for those who have it can be fantastic, in a way that is relating to people's personal experience. It's not easy to do that, and it's not a one-way traffic. That's one of the key things in the book that we're trying to do. We're trying to dialogue with each other, but we're also saying that actually any knowledge at any serious level that we have about life will actually come to us through dialogue with people who are different from us.
Well, I mean, you worked an awful lot with communities up north, so you'd know a lot about dialoguing with different communities.
Yes, I suppose I've done about 30 years working with Republicans and loyalists and unionists and others who are deeply divided from each other. And we find that if we can persuade people to come into the one room, say for a weekend residential, actually the dialogue will run itself. As long as people are passionately divided from each other. Because one of the questions we will ask is, what is it that really matters to you most deeply? And quite often they'll come out as an answer to that question with the political party slogan or their church slogan or whatever. But, you know, gradually they'll get into something deeper, and eventually somebody will say, I don't want my children bullied on their way to school. And somebody else who is an enemy of theirs, and who may even have killed some of their loved ones, will look at them and say in amazement, well, actually, I don't want my children bullied either. And they will begin to discover commonality with each other, but not agreement. And ironically, one of our ground rules is to ban agreement, because we say that, and I think it's true, if we agree with each other about everything, then we cannot dialogue. You can only dialogue with people from whom you are passionately divided in some way, because only in that way can you find out the story that lies behind the other person's position. And in that story lies the richness.
That's an interesting point, isn't it? That it's not necessarily a dialogue if you agree with the person. I guess it's a pleasant conversation would be the alternative, but you're not really getting to the heart of something. You know, what do you think about that?
I would agree with that, because it's very easy in ecumenical and other settings to try and get to the lowest common denominator, and that's not enriching. And likewise, easy answers are not enriching. We both feel and hopefully pose a lot more questions than we give answers, because if you've got an answer, you switch off your mind. And the churches historically have been very good at getting people to switch off their mind at the door of the church. You've got to believe what the pastor says. You've got to believe what the church says. You've got to believe what the Bible says or the creeds say. And people stop thinking. And when you stop thinking, you stop living, you stop relating. And I think that's another side of the same thing that Brian is talking about. Questions are more important than answers. Dialogue more important than agreement. And through questions, through dialogue, we grow in faith, grow as individuals, and to me that's enormously enriching.
That was a very big point that you brought up, like the importance of questions. And you also mentioned that you were potentially the first two from Catholic and Protestant backgrounds who had actually co-authored a book, as opposed to having produced a book that had essays from different faith traditions. But you're talking now about dialoguing with secularism, and that's become the new divide, if you like. You know, it's like there isn't really so much of a divide between different Christian groups. The Christian groups, in a way, have almost united in terms of how they can dialogue now with secularism.
I mean, I think the good thing about secularism is that it can actually challenge our own Christian views. The reality is that all of us live within a bubble. People don't realise that, but including myself.
even that.
But it's we need to be aware of that. I mean, we're sitting in a room now. You cannot see this room from the outside, because we're inside it. And that's important. And secularists have important questions for Christians. I mean, what are you talking about if you're talking about an afterlife? What are you talking about if you're talking about a God who's actually present in our actual world, and a God is at work in our world? What are you talking about if you're talking about a God who's all-powerful? Actually, my response to that particular question is to say, well, God is as powerful as a broken piece of flesh on the cross, because the broken piece of flesh on the cross is the ultimate revelation, the ultimate view that we have of God. And you know what? A broken piece of flesh on a cross is powerless. The extraordinary thing about our God in our Christian theology is that God has handed everything over to us. I keep telling her, as I sometimes say, that was a very bad idea, but she doesn't listen to me. But I mean, I think that we can probe questions of that, and we can probe it more usefully with people who are different from us. Now, at the same time, I think we have to witness to the truth of what we're doing. And that's why the scandals within my own church, particularly in the area of abuse, are so appalling. But also things like the discrimination against women in the church. I simply think it has no scriptural foundation at all. The idea that you can't ordain married clergy. We already have married clergy in the Catholic Church. We have Anglicans, people from Tim's Church, who have left Tim's Church and joined my church. often because of the problems they have with Anglicans ordaining women. But they're married clergy within the Catholic Church, and in England you've had the crazy situation sometimes of a Catholic priest leaving because he wants to get married and being replaced the following week by a person who's a former Anglican who happens to be married. And we also have had people from the Orthodox churches who are in full union with Rome who had married clergy for hundreds of years. Pope Francis has put out an invitation to bishops' conferences to say, look, come and ask if you want some change in this area. The Irish Bishops' Conference have done nothing about this except talk about charges of priests and putting parishes together. Lay people deserve the Eucharist. They need the Eucharist. In our tradition, you do need priesthood for that, and you can argue about that, but that's our tradition. So it's time to move on this stuff, not just to keep putting this stuff off. And without an effective bishops' conference putting forward tough questions like this, we're going to end up with a desert church.
You're bringing up a lot of good points and a lot of things that people are addressing and trying to deal with and trying to challenge. But, you know, within the Anglican tradition, in theory, you know, people look at you and think, well, you've got all those boxes ticked, but you're still dealing with issues, you know?
Oh, we're still dealing big time with issues. I mean, there's a very big issue within Anglicanism, particularly over sexuality at the moment, and it's deeply divisive, and it's not simple. My side of the argument is very much on the liberal, although I dislike that label, and the conservatives would take a more traditional viewpoint. We need to get to the point where we listen to each other, learn to respect each other. I still disagree with you. I disagree with you actually very strongly, and these are the reasons I do. And then they can come back with the same thing. But hopefully at the end of it, we can say, yeah, we're both trying to respond to Christ. We're both trying to respond to individuals in their need, in their pain, in their self-awareness. Let's continue the dialogue, but all the time respecting people and respecting the gospel and the church so we seek to communicate.
And one point that Tim made in the book was the difference between the Church of Ireland Synod 1 year and the following year, precisely because there had been a prayerful dialogue in between. And the prayerful part of that dialogue, it changed the way people approached the issue so that they were still divided, but they were able to handle the difference in a much deeper and a better way.